We have a, as I well know, an alcoholic in good standing in our program who's come all the way from Colorado to be with us tonight. And we just shared a little bit before the meeting and talking about the weather out there and all. And Bob said that he could be playing golf out there today, too. It looks like I played hooky, too, today. I did. But we just shared a little bit, but I do know this, that anybody that will come and give up their weekend and be with us in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is a good AA, and I know he's got a good story, and I'm not going to take up any more Bob O's time. He's from Littleton, Colorado, and thank you, Bob.
Thank you. My name is Bob Olson. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. It's by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't found a need or an excuse to take a drink today, nor have I found a need or an excuse to take a drink since May 28th, 1973, and for that I am truly grateful. I had some extra time today. I was sitting around. It's not good for me to have extra time. I was trying to contact U.S. Air, and so I had a lot of time thinking. I was thinking, I wonder if all those things that I used to do were as much fun as I thought they were. So just for grins, I thought maybe after the meeting tonight, I'd go out and find some lower companions and then just for grins beat one of them senseless. I assume they don't like that any better down here than they did where I come from, so I'm sure I'd get a chance to see if spending the night in jail with four or five other psychopaths was as much fun as I thought it was. And then I could get beat senseless in that process, and I could wake up tomorrow morning not knowing who I was or where I am, and maybe not. I really want to thank Ben. Ben's been a really good host. Ben really takes care of you. I mean, he's... If you got somebody coming down here you really want to take care of, give them to Ben. This is the first time that I can remember that I've stood in front of a group and didn't have a suit on. But when I got Charlotte yesterday, they canceled my flight in here, and I didn't get here until, like, I don't think I got to the hotel till like 11:15 last night. And my luggage didn't make it with me, which is why I was talking to U.S. Air and playing games in my head all day. And but my luggage did get here at 4 o'clock. Unfortunately, it was soaking wet, and they had left it out in a rainstorm last night. And as a consequence, I had a leather case in there with it. And now my suit and my shirts are the color of the leather case. Isn't that fun? Now the question is, what the hell's that got to do with? Right? If it was 24 years ago today and that was the only suit and the only shirt I had, that would be a big deal, wouldn't it? And you know what? After the meeting tonight, instead of going out to find some lower companions, I'm going to sit down and figure out what kind of new suit I'm going to buy. And actually, that's kind of a nice... I like to think about stuff like that, you know, and fortunately, U.S. Air has already agreed to do that. The experience for me in coming to a Joe and Charlie weekend is a different kind of deal than just going and talking at an AA convention. You know, Charlie and I were talking about this earlier, but this is like a focus group, okay? you need to know that the vast majority of people in Alcoholics Anonymous don't have a clue. I hope you don't find this too offensive, but the truth is that most of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous would never do what you've done this weekend, which is to give a whole weekend of your time to find out how to do these things. Okay? Now, the truth about Alcoholics Anonymous has always been that we have this set of spiritual exercises that we do, and we get closer to God in the process. That's the truth. But most people today, for whatever reason, come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have the perspective of going all over the country a lot to talk to groups. And most people come into Alcoholics Anonymous and think that by their very presence they are somehow protected. And I can tell you that if you're an alcoholic of the same variety that I am, you aren't. Okay? And you are just hanging on borrowed time. So the fact that you're here this weekend to learn more about this process is a wonderful statement in your favor. And see, I can say things to you that I would not talk about to other people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, anyway. I'm a retread. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1968. Couldn't get it. Used to go to AA meetings all screwed up. Used to be drunk, be high on pills, be all kinds of stuff. But never went to an AA meeting sober. And it was always kind of fun. I liked to go to AA meetings because they would just stroke the hell out of you when you went there. You'd walk in there and people would come up and they'd do this to you. It's like petting a dog. And they would go, "Everything's going to be all right." What a lie. You know, and I'd sit there and I loved it. I mean, nobody else was paying any attention to me. My wife hated me. My kids were afraid of me. I mean, nobody wanted anything to do with me except the people that I hung around in the bars with. And every once in a while, just for grins, we'd go to an AA meeting. And then you'd walk in there and they'd do that number on you. You know, I don't tell people that. People go, "Well, I may have a little drinking problem." And you go, "Then you're going to die." And they go, "Excuse me?" You go, "Well, the truth about that is that you have a progressive and fatal disease. And you're going to die. If you don't go nuts and die first." And, you know, the book talks about this. And I understand I'm starting at the other end of the deal. But when you're talking to someone like that, the book talks about the fatal feature, right? And so you're sitting there going, "No, if you got alcoholism, you're going to die." And they'll sit there and they'll have this really funny look on their face. And all of a sudden the light will go on. And they'll go, "How come you're not dead?" Right? And then you got them. It was funny, I was listening to Joe and Charlie talking today about your concept of God. This is really funny. I mean, there are some hilarious jokes in Alcoholics. They're sort of spiritual jokes. I wouldn't say this in a regular AA meeting. In a regular AA convention. Your concept of God. Do you really think that if you think God's something different, he's going to change? Well, you know what that's about? That's about comfort level. Now, see, I believe in God the Father, okay? Because I want a father. And I didn't have much of one, frankly. So That's probably not... I mean, that's probably taking something away from someone who really wanted to and couldn't. But the truth is that I wanted a father. So my idea about God is God the Father, okay? But that doesn't alter God. That just gives me a comfort level to deal with God. So whether you want God the Father, God the Principal, God the Employer, God the whatever it is, that really has to do with your comfort level of God. Okay? You know, it's always fun about, because people go, well, I know what God is. Good. If you know God, you are God. That's the theological argument. Okay? So, somebody asked me today, I have a terrible problem, they said. And you go, okay, and they said, I'm having a terrible time making a decision. See, and you come in here to Alcoholics Anonymous, you get intuitive thought. You had it before you ever got here, a sense of right and wrong. Okay? So someone comes up to me and says, I'm having a terrible time making this decision. You know what the truth is in Alcoholics Anonymous? We don't have a terrible time making a decision. We have a terrible time accepting a decision. All right? We already know what to do. We just don't like it. This has been a very interesting weekend. I showed up on May 28th in 1973. I woke up on the floor of an empty house in a little town in Wisconsin. I think more dead than alive. And a guy who had been my sponsor on my occasional forays into Alcoholics Anonymous showed up. God only knows why, except he said I called him, which I don't remember. Okay, and so he shows up, and as was his habit, he showed up with a brand new guy in tow. And he's going, Dick, this is an alcoholic, you know. And I'm looking at these guys like they're from the moon. And this guy my old sponsor, Leo, shows up and he's going, Dick, go in the kitchen, find honey and orange juice if you can, and we're going to keep him from going into DTs, which ultimately they didn't do, incidentally. And so they start making me drink this foul, hideous concoction of stuff. I mean, you should put a little Worcestershire sauce in there or something. And I'm laying on the floor. But the new guy looked like he suffered from hyperactivity. And he was dancing around me going, oh, my God, what are we going to do? See, that's when you like to have a 357, see? Because you just blow that jerk away right on the spot. And it took me to a halfway house. Ultimately, I got to a halfway. It was run by a priest. Now, I was brought up a German Lutheran. This was run by a Catholic priest. And they sat me down in front of him, and all I could do was focus on his collar. And this gentleman became one of my best friends, but at that point in time, you know, I grew up in the neighborhood I grew up in. It was really polarized, and Catholic priests were not well thought of. And I'm sitting in front of him, and he goes, "Are you through?" And I said, well, I hope so. See, and that's the best question you can ask a drunk. Are you done drinking? So what if he says no? And say, good luck, and get up and leave. Honest to God, what's the most redundant thing in the book? Don't go help somebody who doesn't want help. Okay? Get him to the bottom. We think we're doing everybody a favor by being so generous and nice with these people. And see, what I believe after 23-plus years in Alcoholics Anonymous is, don't be generous, be truthful. By all means, please God, tell them the truth about alcoholism. Don't be blowing smoke up their butt about they're going to be great, you know, and everything's going to be fine, because it isn't. They're going to go through some tough times before they ever even get both feet on the ground again. He asked this priest, they sat me down in front of him, he said, are you all through? And I said, I hope so. And he said, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yeah, I am. And I knew it. And he said, do you want what we have? And I don't know. You know, what kind of a question is that? Well, do you have mumps? I don't know what... You know, I'm sitting there looking at this guy in an office, and he's asking me if I want what he has. I don't know. I do know. I don't care what he's got is better than what I got. Okay? So I assumed that the right answer was yes. He said, you willing to go to any lengths to do it? What is the best questions you can ask a drunk? Okay? Are you through? Are you an alcoholic? Are you willing to go to any lengths? Okay? That gets right to the core of the problem. What are you willing to do? You know why so many people come into Alcoholics Anonymous, or why I believe it? I'm going to give you an opinion, which really isn't worth anything. You know why so many people come in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous now? And the recovery rate is lower? It's because people aren't as desperate as they were before. You know, and it's hard for people who are desperate, who come into Alcoholics Anonymous. When the book talks about it, it talks about with all the desperation of a drowning man. And we've seen people coming into Alcoholics Anonymous going, my counselor said I ought to investigate this. You know, how'd you like to investigate the bottom of my boot? When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was absolutely desperate. I reached a point in my life where if I took another drink, I knew it was going to kill me. I knew I was going to die. I'm not talking about die, get sick. I'm talking about die, die. I knew if I took another drink, I was going to die. And I knew if I didn't take another drink, I was going to die. What's left? There is no middle ground there. Okay? So what you do when you get to that point is you lose all hope. Then you're done. Then it's no longer, are you going to die? The question is, how are you going to die, or when are you going to die? And that's how I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, with that sense of desperation. And see, a lot of people don't come here. Maybe they don't get out there long enough. Or maybe they don't belong here. Or I don't know what the heck it is, but they I don't know what to do with those people. Okay? That's why I wind up with the bottom of the barrel. I'm a bottom fisher in AA. Okay? I pick up the carp and the catfish. I get people nobody else wants. See, because it's those people that if they don't follow the directions in this program, they're going to wander off and die in their own puke. Okay? And if somebody doesn't have a clear and precise message, the kind that you're getting from Charlie and Joe this weekend, they have absolutely no hope at all. So what can you do for those guys? You know, when people come into my home group, didn't mention that, did I? I remember the Happy Way group in Englewood, Colorado. I didn't pick the name. the Happy Way group? Doesn't that sound like one of those AA groups that goes, let's have a dance? Good. See, it sounds like a bunch of people on Thorazine. I'm embarrassed to tell you the name of my home group. God, you know what? So what? Well, I forgot what I was going to say, so I'm going back to the room now. I had some brain damage, I think. Because there's some holes in here. And every once in a while, something will fall in there. And it never, ever comes out. It just... We need to tell people the truth. You know, the two things that concern me about Alcoholics Anonymous, one of them is that we don't have a very clear message. See, and it's people like you who will sit in a meeting like this weekend who will learn a clear message. A clear message about what Alcoholics Anonymous has to offer. We don't have anything to offer besides the steps. Did you know that? That everything arises out of that. And see, what they found out in the Washingtonians and what they found out in the Oxford group and what they found out in Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you want to recover from alcoholism, you somehow have to get closer to God and have God take care of your alcoholism. And the only way that we seem to be able to do that is with this set of spiritual exercises that have numbers on them for dummies like me. And everything else arises out of that. The fellowship arises out of that. Serenity arises out of that. All those stupid things that they have meetings about arise out of that. Everything arises out of having done the steps, the spiritual exercises of this program. You know, it's kind of interesting. I made a decision not too long ago to not talk at conventions anymore. Okay? I've been doing it for 20 years. It's somebody else's turn. And so I can tell you anything I want. It's unlikely that I'll come back here. So you're going to get it. God bless you. No, you know what? I mean, the truth is always the same. And all I'm going to tell you is what my experience is in what Joe and Charlie are talking about. Okay? When they talked about if when you want to, you find you can't quit entirely, I had to look at that. Could I quit? Yeah, for a day or two. Okay? Or if once I started, do I have a little control over the amount I take? Yeah? I can't predict anything. Okay? I just can't. You put alcohol in me, and I become a raving maniac. I was a 240-pound psychopath bill collector on the north side of Chicago. I mean, I am everybody's dream. I used to show up at people's doors, and if the woman answered the door, they would immediately break into tears. And if the guy was there, he'd just lock the door. And I used to kick in doors and beat people up against the walls and do funny psychological tricks, like talk to them like there's nothing going on while you're beating the hell out of them. And they just collapse, get in the fetal position, do things like that. I was a really sweet person. People used to bring me like peace offerings. They like a big bag of strawberries or something. Please tell Mr. Olson who this is from. And tell them we're going to make our payment on time. I mean, it was awful. You know what? At the same time, I was the president of the JCs. I was president of the Optimist Club. I was voted one of the outstanding young men in the community. and I was on the governor's committee for mental health. Did that tell you anything about Wisconsin? When I was sober about 90 days, I was still shaking and I was still sweating and I didn't make any sense, and I would sit in the meetings and I was terrified to say anything and terrified that anybody was going to call on me, and I was a psychological mess. And my sponsor came up to me and said, "Why are you sober?" And I said, "It's because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." And he said, "Bullshit. You've been hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years. What are you doing differently?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, are you eating differently?" And I said, "No." And he said, are you exercising?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You going to work every day?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, what are you doing differently?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Why are you praying?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "Why are you doing that?" And I said, "Because you told me to." And he said, "Were you doing that before?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Do you believe in what you're praying about?" And I said, "No, I don't." And he asked me, for a guy with a sixth grade education, he asked me a really profound question. And the question is, would you concede that you're sober today by the grace of a God you don't even believe in? See? And I looked for every other excuse to be sober, and I had not been sober in years. Okay? I drank a lot of booze. A lot of booze. And all of a sudden I wasn't drinking it. And didn't want to drink it. Okay? And I had to consider the fact that maybe God was operating in my life and I had somehow invited him in without believing in him. The book says, if you're even willing to believe upon the simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. Okay? So the cornerstone of my belief is this willingness to believe. I kind of was willing to try to believe. And I got sober anyway. Okay? We don't have to do this perfectly. If you're trying to get closer to God, God understands that. When they say that willingness is the key, it's about, are you willing to get into this? See, what you're going to see at some point in time, if you stay sober long enough and you continue to do this, you will see that life has become a spiritual adventure. Okay? That's an exciting place to be. It's also a difficult place to be. Okay? But this is an interesting way to live life. You know what one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself is choose how you want to live your life. You think you can do that? You have a responsibility to do that. You know, God didn't take the chains of alcoholism off you so you could park in a corner someplace. We all have these skills and abilities and special talents and all the rest of this. We are not stupid people. We are talented people. And the idea that somehow when we get sober we go park in a corner somewhere or hide in a closet is like spitting in God's face. So why don't you go out and see what you're capable of? If you got God in your life, what do you have to be afraid of? So, I don't care at what point in your life you're at. Why don't you go out and see if you can do something? Why don't you... You know, God put us in this position so we could grow in understanding and effectiveness and affect other people's lives positively. We're not sober just because we're supposed to be sober. Okay? We get to go do something with that. So one of the greatest gifts in sobriety is a willingness to risk. You get up against your fear and you go, "I don't care, it ain't going to kill me. And what doesn't kill me makes me stronger." Okay? That must be one strong... So that's what we do. You know, I came to believe because there was no other choice, because it was the only thing that made sense. I don't have to know what God is. I don't even play the games, okay? I understand that if I need to make decisions, I just go make them. And I make mistakes all the time. And so it's not a big deal for me to make a mistake. I'll just go make a mistake, and if that isn't the right thing to do, I'll go do something else. But most of the time it is. Intuitive thought is an interesting process. The book says that we will eventually come to trust it, that we may do some funny things in the process, put ourselves in some funny situations following our intuitive thought around, but the truth is that it eventually becomes a working part of the mind. Okay? You don't want to miss that. Go test it, okay? See if what you're thinking is your intuitive thought. Yeah, well. Book says, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could neither postpone nor evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or he isn't. He's either everything or he's nothing. And it says, what is your choice to be? Okay? My self-imposed crisis is it's self-imposed. You know, is there anybody in this room that somebody grabbed and threw down on the ground and poured liquor down their throat? I don't see any hands. This is self-imposed. You know why? I am the architect of my life, both drunk and sober. Okay. So my self-imposed crisis. My crisis is that isn't my alcoholism. Even though alcoholism is a progressive and fatal disease, my crisis is that I can't fix myself. You know, if I have some other disease, I can fix it or a doctor can fix it, but chances are somebody can fix it most of the time. But this one I can't fix, okay? I am powerless in the face of my alcoholism. So my crisis is I can't fix myself. And then the book says something that really doesn't sound good. It says no human power can relieve my alcoholism. Okay? Now I can't fix me and you can't fix me. There better be another choice here. You know what it says in the book is here we are squarely confronted with the issue of faith. Uh-huh. Because if there isn't a God, I'm all done. Okay? I'm on the way out then. So everything in this program turns around at some point to there better be a God. Okay? I belong to the group that I belong, the Happy Way group in Englewood. We do the work over and over again. I mean, not ad nauseum. We got a step workshop going up there right now, and we're all writing inventory. Okay, I mean, we started with one, but we're on inventory right now, and it's really funny because you know how nuts you get when you write inventory. So you got 40 people in a room that are all writing inventory. It's amazing. I mean, if anybody came in there with a gun, everybody'd be dead. My self-imposed crisis is that I can't fix myself. I need to rely on a God, okay? I got to that point in my program in 1975. There was an international in Denver, international convention. There were 17,000 people there, which admittedly isn't as big as the 70 or 80 or 90 or whatever there was in San Diego, but back then there was a lot of people. And I was on the hospitality committee. And we listened to a guy named Mac Cheater, who was from Winnipeg, and he's dead now. But he was a great speaker. And he talked about the Golden Slipper group in Winnipeg, and how they call them the Golden Slippers because nobody could stay sober. And they just got sick of it. I mean, they were planting all their friends, and they couldn't figure out how to stop the carnage. And so they decided to take a whole new tack with AA and that they would stop talking about the steps. Okay? and they'd stop intellectualizing about the steps, and they'd stop rationalizing about the steps, and they would take a whole new approach towards AA. They would do the steps. I asked a guy a question today. I said, you know, out of that 500 people that showed up for this step weekend, I'd like to know how many of you go home and do it. I'd sure like to know that. I will tell you that I do this as reluctantly today as I ever did. And I've probably written 25 inventories. And not by themselves, I have gone from 1 to 12, probably 25 times. And as a result, my perception has changed and my life has changed and da-da-da-da. This is a wonderful process, even if we don't want to do it. This convention came to town, he talked about the golden slippers, and we decided we'd go do that. So about 15 of us got together, and we did exactly what he suggested, which is we sat down, we started reading this book, and we started at the forward to the first edition where it says to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Okay? It's interesting from a perspective standpoint that they say that. It says to show others precisely what we did. Doesn't say what you ought to do. Okay? All they're saying is, you know, from our perspective, this is what we've done already. I know that if you are a helpless, hopeless, burned out, blown away alcoholic like I am, that if you do this stuff, it'll save your life and it'll change it at the same time. Okay? When we got to the third step, my sponsor, we were reading the book, and he was talking about selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our problem. And I'm looking at him, and I'm going, you're wrong. And he said, why? And I said, selfishness and self-centeredness aren't the root of my problem. Finding a bottle of booze and crawling into it is the root of my problem. And he said, no, you're wrong. And I was forced to believe him. And he said, if you can find the selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear in your life, and you can put those things on a spiritual basis to remove them, you'll never drink again. Okay? You know, at the beginning of the fifth chapter, the beginning of chapter 5 says how it works. And then it talks about how it doesn't work. Notice that? I haven't met enough people to count on one hand in 23 years of sobriety that fit that description, constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Okay? And people come in here and try and hang their hat on it. You got to be a psychopath to fit that description, or a sociopath. And there just aren't that many people like that showing up. Okay? He made me read the prayer. And he told me that I was going to have to memorize it and that I was going to have to come back the following week if I wanted to do that and get on my knees and hold his hands and mean it. Okay? And then he said, now tell me what it means. And I said, well, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. I guess that just gives God an open gangway on my life, okay? That he can do anything with me that he wants. That he can make me anything he wants. That he can kill me or let me live or allow me to see my children grow up or whatever he's got in mind. But it's his deal now. And he said, you better know what the deal is. We thought well before making this decision, knowing that at last we could abandon ourselves utterly to him, is what the book says. Hey, you know how to abandon yourself utterly? I mean, that's totally without reservation, right? And so he said, don't come back and do this unless that's the position you're willing to take. And he said, that means you give God all the power in your life, okay? So, and then, relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Yet bondage, self is my bondage. See, my biggest problem is that I can't see you because I'm so damn busy looking at me, okay? I go through life looking in a periscope that's aimed right back at my forehead. And the problem with that, other than it's just ridiculous, is that it makes everything a big deal. It makes everything real dramatic. It makes everything way out of proportion. And my bondage is that I am chained to that periscope and I can't let go of it. And I can't stop looking at me. And the more I look at me, the sicker I get. Because I get resentful and angry and afraid and all that stuff, dishonest. And what I need to do is I need to look out. The book talks about us being people who place others' welfare above our own. Okay? It's hard to do that when you're looking at yourself. Take away my difficulties, a victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. It's interesting, there's no amen on the end of that, is there? Because it doesn't belong there. Bearing witness means let me be an example. You know, 24 years ago there was no hope for me. Nobody wanted me. I just was going to die. I mean, there was nothing left for me in this world. I was going to wind up like somebody in every generation of my family since they got here from Norway. I was going to go die in a gutter someplace. And I was going to be just one more statistic. Okay? There was no hope for me. And when it says to bear witness, it means let people see that my life has changed and that it's like night and day. People tell me every once in a while about the way I used to be, and it's like they're talking about somebody else. My mind doesn't work that way anymore. Nothing works that way anymore. See, and you can bear witness. Bearing witness, being an example to these people that come in, is when you choose to live a spiritual way of life. When you make a conscious decision to live by spiritual principles, you will be a beacon to people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay? And if you don't choose the way you live, you've done yourself an enormous disservice. Okay? Now, how tough is it to live by spiritual principles? A little tough. Okay? You don't get to do everything you want to do. Tough. I went back after I did that for a week. I thought about it. I came back. He said, do you want to do this? I said, no. And he said, okay. And I said, well, wait a minute. I didn't say I wouldn't do it. I just said I didn't want to do it. And he said, why don't you want to do that? And I said, I don't want to give God that kind of power in my life. And he says, is that what you're afraid of? And I said, yeah. And he said, are you going to do it anyway? And I said, uh-huh. And he said, why? And I said, because I don't want to drink. And he said, then get on your knees and hold my hands and say the prayer and mean it. So I did. Okay? And my life changed. And I got up and he started chuckling, which I thought was totally inappropriate. And I said, what's so funny? And he said, you are. And I said, explain that, please. And he said, you don't want to give God that kind of power in your life? And I said, no. And he said, he's got all power anyway, Bob. This is just an exercise in who's God and who's the drunk. Oh. Said, you bring your legal pad with you? And I said, yes. And he said, then let's start writing inventory. Well, it says if it isn't once followed by a rigorous attempt to clean house, it'll have little permanent brain damage to make that decision. And I thought that it would be much more appropriate for the big book to say, now take 3 months off because you work so hard, and then you can come back afterwards and we'll talk about the inventory. Okay? What's the most compelling statement in the big book? With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. When's the very start? The day they come through the door. How many AA groups have you been to where somebody new comes in and they go, well, you just sit down, drink coffee, right? And when your mind clears up a little bit, we're going to start talking to you about some of the things that you ought to be thinking about. And don't worry about the God stuff. We won't even talk about that for a while. Even though the book says stress the spiritual feature freely and it says we don't apologize for God, people are going, that's all right, honey. We won't do that right now. Why don't you just shoot him? See, you know what a 12-stepping is? He's telling people about the 12 steps. Okay? So when they come through the door, you go, wait, let me tell you what this is. Okay? Let me show you what you came into here. You may think this is just all fun and games and that we're just having a hell of a good time here, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. But let me tell you what this is about. I need 30 minutes of your time to explain the 12 steps to you. Okay? And then if you still want to be a part of this fellowship, you'll know exactly what you're getting into. You know what the book says? It says if you don't tell them in advance, they may come along at some point and say you misled them. Okay? Well, you didn't tell me about inventory. You didn't tell me that I had to make amends. Okay? So we 12-step, everybody comes through the door. Okay? They come in, they get to know. This is what we have to offer you. And if you stay around and you do those things, then you can sit around, drink coffee, and smoke cigarettes and do all the stuff we're doing. Okay? But you need to do this. I wrote this inventory. My sponsor said list, right? Grudge list. People, institutions, and principles. So I write it all down. And he said, okay, now in the next column, I want you to write down why you're mad at him. But don't, and I went, here's now. We're getting to it. Yeah, I'm going to tell you what these guys did to me. Okay? And he said, you know, I don't think more than 6 or 8 words in that column. And I mean, that was going to be my shining glory. And he said, it doesn't make much difference what they did to you. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. Now, and then I want you to write in the next column there, self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal and sex relations, pocketbooks, right? So I did that. I came back and I said, I'm done. And he said, no, you're not. I want you to go back and write some more. And I said, what's left? And he said, now it's important for you to see what your part in it was. And I said, how do you do that? And he said, you write down everywhere where you were selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. So I did that. Came back. Said, I'm done with my inventory. You know what? This took me a month, maybe. And I was a salesman on the road at the time. So I was in motels doing this stuff at night. And he said, well, you're not done. And I said, what's left? And he said, a fear inventory. And I said, I'm not afraid of anything. That's what he said. He has a real odd sense of humor, which I've never been able to understand. And he said, "You're not afraid of anything?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, then the big book must be wrong." And I said, "Why?" And he said, he said, "Well, it says something interesting in there. It says, fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it." And he said, "If the fabric of your existence isn't shot through with fear, maybe you're in the wrong place." Right? And I said, "Well, Don, you know me. I was a bill collector on the north side of Chicago. I mean, it's just, I was absolutely fearless. And, you know, I've been shot at. I've been, you know, in shooting wars. I've done everything. I've had every kind of weapon and come at me, and I just, you know, I'm just not afraid." And he said, "No kidding. Well, humor me." And I said, "All right." And he said, "How about snakes?" And I said, "What kind of snakes?" And he said, "What about rattlesnakes?" And I said, "Well, you wouldn't want to be in a closet with one." And he said, "Okay, write down snakes." And I said, "Right." And he said, "How about spiders?" And I said, "Like black widows?" And he said, "Uh-huh." And I said, "Well, you'd have to be a fool to want to get bit by one." And he said, "Okay, well, write down spiders." And then he said, "How about failure?" Oh, cheap shot. That. They always said I was going to wind up like my dad. They always said, you know, they were telling me when I was 10 years old that I was going to wind up in a gutter like my father. Well, what the hell kind of a thing is that say to a kid? You know, if your grown-up's telling you that, you believe them. So he said, "Write down failure. How about inadequacy?" "Well, I never thought I was as good as other people." And he said, "Okay, write down inadequacy. How about the police?" "You mean when they're right behind you in a squad car?" And he said, "Yeah, that'd be good." And I said, "Mm-hmm." And he said, "Write down the police. How about women?" And I went, "Well, he said, "Just write down women." "What about children?" "Just the real little ones. They got them all wrapped up like little mummies, and then they hand them to you." And I said, "I don't want them. I'm afraid I'm going to drop them or something." Okay? And he said, "Write down infants." "What about the courts?" "Yeah. You know, I got sentenced to 2 years in penitentiary when I was 17 years old for assault. And I figured I got a bad deal, and I really didn't, if you want to know the truth." And he said, "Write down the courts." And there was this long silence. And he said, "Is there anything you're not afraid of?" And I said, "I guess not." So I wrote down all those things that I was afraid of and applied that question against them. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Yes. That question to me smacks of, in the absence of God, do you have good reason to be afraid of all of those things? And the answer is yes. If there is no God, those things that are on my fear inventory are things that I ought to be afraid of. But if you turn the question around and you say, if you are standing in the presence of God, do you have reason to be fearful of those things? No. Almost invariably, if I go out and do this, if I go out and talk at a convention, people, three, four, or a half dozen or something, will come up and go, aren't you afraid to get up there in front of all those people? Right? No. You know why? Because when I got to God the Father, see, I never had that experience, but I've got kids, okay? And so when I think about God the Father, I think about myself as like maybe a six-year-old, all right? And I've got my arm around God's leg, and he has his hand on my shoulder. And when I told my eight-year-old 3 weeks ago that I wasn't going to talk at conventions anymore and that he and I were going to start playing golf and we were going to do all that stuff, he was standing there with his arm around my leg, okay, looking up at me. And I had my hand on his shoulder. And he said, that's wonderful. Okay? And that's the relationship that I want with my God. And that's what I have. I didn't mean to do that. You know what? You know, this is all about belief systems. When you write inventory, it's about belief systems. About what do I believe doesn't work, okay? And one of the things that I believe that doesn't work is what is a man? See, men can't cry, right? Damn right, okay? And so I don't mean you get up there and blubber through your whole talk. But what I believe doesn't work. And what I believe, and I constantly have to see what I believe. And most of it doesn't work. Okay? And I don't know how to not believe that stuff. And so I have to go to God and say, will you remove this and put something back that makes sense? And if you do it long enough, he just keeps putting things back in there that make sense. Okay? I don't have any reason to be afraid up here. What are you going to do, shoot me? What I have a responsibility to do here is try and tell the truth as I understand it. Okay? And that responsibility is to be clear. Now, what's the other thing that I'm afraid of is that we don't have the courage of our convictions. So we have people coming into A meetings going, I think all these substances are the same. And AA ought to let everybody in. And everybody goes, you know what? One of the great gifts of sobriety is this willingness to risk. And part of a willingness to risk is a willingness to take unpopular positions. All right? They go, well, I'm really a cocaine addict, and I'm not an alcoholic in any way, shape, or form, but my counselor told me to come to these closed AA meetings. So we take them in the other room and explain to them what a closed AA meeting is and give them the number of CA. Okay? And when I get up in a meeting and say, I'm sorry, you can't stay, it polarizes a meeting. They go, oh, Bob, you are such a jerk. Well, who's going to do it? So you get somebody that comes into your meeting and you know that they're dying and they're going down the wrong road, and people just sit there and go, oh, who's going to tell them? Who's going to do it? Who's going to get up and walk over there and say, you better get your head out of your ass or you're going to die? Who's going to do it? Learn to do it. the kindest thing you can do to people is tell them the truth. Okay? The kindest. I wrote this whole fear inventory out, came back and said, I'm done. And he said, no, you're not. Now you got a sex inventory. I went, oh, right. I thought, my shining moment. Right? I went into that thinking, I am done. One. Came out looking like Elmer Fudd. It's about, are they selfish or not? Are relationships selfish or not? Do I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? You bet. You know what I found out when I was 10 years sober and I was divorced in AA after 22 years of marriage? I found out, I met a woman I wanted to spend the rest of my life with. Unfortunately, I don't think she wants to spend the rest of it with me. And I knew I was totally unprepared to be in a relationship. Okay? I mean, I knew I didn't have a clue. I didn't have a chance. I'm sitting there looking at it. You know, it's like looking at Playboy magazine. Okay? Why? You ain't ever going to be there. I'm looking at this and going, I am unprepared. I mean, I am truly unprepared, and I will walk in there and screw this up. And one of the reasons why I knew that was because jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness were my tools in a relationship. It's all based on this belief system that I am such a piece of dog manure that if this lady ever gets both feet on the ground long enough to get a good look at me, they'll be out of here faster than I can spit. Okay? So I saw it in my 11th step. I'd say, God, please show me how to do this. And he took me to someone that made me go through these terrible exercises. This woman made me bring my girlfriend over there and say, and her name was Lori, and she'd sit down and she'd say, now, Bob, are you angry with Lori? And I went, uh-huh. And she'd say, why? Well, this is what she said to me. And then this lady would say, Lori, is that what you said? And Lori'd go, no. Well, what did you say? Well, I said this. Is that what you heard, Bob? No. Well, maybe you have faulty hearing. Okay? And then she'd say, any other reason why you're mad at her? Yeah. Why? Because she said that. That hurt. Is that what you said? No. What'd you say? This is what I said. What'd you mean? That's what I meant. Is that what you heard, Bob? No. You do have faulty hearing. So what'd I do? That's not in the big book, is it? So what'd I do? I want to know. You know what I found out? I found out I hear what I think you're going to say. And there's no way you can get me off of that. Okay? So I hear what I think you're going to say, and then I make decisions on what I think. That's a mistake. Okay? So I went around for a year, and every time somebody hurt me, I would say, excuse me, this is what I heard you say. Is that what you really said? See, and 99% of the time they went, no. That's not what I said at all. See, and my problem is that my perception is faulty. My hearing is faulty, my perception is faulty. And so if I walk into a room with you and you look at me and you say, look, I just don't have time to do this right now. What I hear you say is, you are worthless and not worth my time. And what you said to me was, I'm sorry, I'm so busy, I may be so confused, or I am so upset at this point in time that I can't do service to a conversation with you. How do I know that? Because I write so damn much inventory that it's got to come to you at some point. Okay? When the book talks about growing in understanding and effectiveness, it's talking about growing in understanding and effectiveness as a result of doing these things over and over again. When Joe and Charlie were talking about a business that takes no regular inventory will fail, works that way for us too. Okay? I take regular inventories. You know why? Because my tent stuff isn't perfect. Because I can't stay up with my own character defects. That the greatest danger to me as an alcoholic is the resurgence of self. I can go through this inventory and I can beat self down to something that big by learning the truth. And it grows back. Okay? It's awful. And the only way I can attack that is by doing this over and over again. Now, I'm amazed by people who do it once. I mean, I don't know how they stay sober. I can't. But you know what? God loves all of us. And I don't understand everything, and he's got his own designs, and I don't know. All I want to know is that in order to be effective with alcoholics who are coming through the door, I need to know everything I can about my own behavior, because you act just like I do. We do something on the end which isn't in the book, so I probably shouldn't even talk about it. But we put the take it to the grave stuff there, okay? And the only reason why we do that is because the book talks about every dark cranny of the past, okay? And we want people to be clean. We don't want them carrying baggage they don't need to carry, because that stuff is generally not very exciting at all, okay? I asked a priest one time, the priest that was standing there, that was sitting there in a halfway house when I went in, he and I used to do a lot of fishing together after I got sober, and I said, Father, you ever hear anything new in confession? And he said, not after about the fifth one. And I said, fifth steps are like that. They are. I bet I've heard hundreds of fifth steps. And I never hear anything new anymore. Okay? I don't care what you did. There's a good percentage of people in this room who've done everything you've ever done. And you have no reason to be carrying that kind of baggage around, being terribly fearful at some point that someone will find out, because it's meaningless. Okay? Don't carry that kind of baggage. It's just extra weight. I fifth step with my sponsor, and you need to know this. I am not a person who is very social by nature. I'm antisocial by nature. I am a loner, and it's something that is one of my character defects that I'm trying to deal with, and I'm not very successful with it, I'll tell you that. But I don't let people in my life easily, okay? I just don't. I lived with four or five different families when I was a kid and got the idea it wasn't worthwhile. I mean, when you got your fifth set of mothers and fathers and stuff like that, at some point it just looks like a blur. And, you know, so that's... But I had let this guy into my life, my sponsor. And he was, and I liked it. I liked having that kind of close relationship with another man. And I fifth-stepped this, and I knew what was going to happen. I knew he was going to turn around to me at the end of the fifth step, and he was going to go, I appreciate you doing this, but please don't come around me or my family anymore. Especially don't want you around my wife or my children. And please don't tell anyone that I'm your sponsor. And he didn't do that. You know, he put his arms around me. He told me he loved me. And that he was so happy that I'd done that. Okay. What I learned in that process was I could be Genghis Khan. I could be the worst guy in the world. And if my intent is to get all better every day, if my intent is to participate in a spiritual way of life, if my intent is to change all that and to become better, that you're willing to accept me, or most of you are. Okay? And so I don't care how bad you are, where you came from, or anything else. You can find a home here if you choose to participate. Okay? I went home and did 6 and 7, taking the book down from the shelf. Did I put it up on the shelf and took it down? Reviewed the first 5 proposals, make sure I hadn't made mortar without sand. Did that whole deal, okay? And I was clear. Sometimes you can get stuck in the middle of that. Don't. There's a line in the book that says more will be revealed to us. So just keep going. Unless you really left something out on purpose, okay? And then you got to go back and clean that up. And I did 6 and 7. You know, the prayer, 7-step prayer, you know, I was willing to be rid of all that stuff. And the 7-step prayer talks about remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you, which in my mind immediately turns to which are useful and which aren't. Sort of an ambivalent statement. I know an awful lot of people who can tell you that their perception changed in the 7th step. Okay? That they really had the sense of changing their life at that point in the program. That was my perception. My perception is that I'd come over the hill. Okay? And that I was on a different basis. There's a line in there that I think is one of the most important things to look at in the book, and it's a description about how people like you and I drink again. Okay? It talks about resentments, and it says, when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit, the insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again, and for us to drink is to die. And that's how we drink again. We give safe harbor to those things, okay? And when it talks about God, it talks about the essence of God being deep down within all of us, okay? And then it says something interesting. It says it may be obscured, may be covered over, okay? It may be obscured by pomp, ceremony, or the worship of other things. How easy is it to worship other things? Real easy. Cars, sex, money, jobs, position, all those things. When I start worshiping them instead of God, I'm in trouble. Okay? And the essence of God in me may be covered over by all those things. And what does that mean? You know, if God's inside all of us, there's an interesting spiritual question. And the spiritual question is God on the inside trying to get out, or on the outside trying to get in? And see, I think if the essence of God is within us, and we can peel the onion by finding out about selfishness and dishonesty and resentment and fear, and understand that we worship other things and quit the pomp and the ceremony, that God's life will shine out from us. And we will then be a beacon to others. Okay? Well, I'm sure if they haven't talked about it, I'm sorry I was on the phone with you. I was here all afternoon because I missed part of this. But, you know, it says we made a list of all the persons we'd harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. And the next line is we did it when we took inventory. Okay? And I enjoyed listening to these guys about everybody's guide. Yeah. Well, you can make a big bonfire out of that crap. And if you take your resentment list, you got most of your amends list, okay? And then what we do is we just sit down with our sponsors and we define the harm. Because we don't want to go to people if we haven't hurt them. Sometimes we think we've hurt everybody, and the truth is we probably haven't hurt everybody, but we probably hurt a lot of people. So it's useful to me to have someone else's perspective. So I go to my sponsor and I say, well, tell me what you think. Here's what I think. And so we go through that. I got to my father, and he said, why don't you have amends there? And I said, because I didn't do anything to him. He was the one that left when I was a kid. He was the guy who used to beat me up. He was the guy that was creating all the problems. I didn't do anything. And he said, well, didn't he used to call you on your birthday every year? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, wasn't he a really bad drunk? And I said, yeah. And he said, what would you do when he called you on your birthday? And I said, well, I'd hang up on him. And he said, why would you do that? And I said, because he was slurring so badly. My dad had a wet brain, okay? He would be slurring so badly, I could tell who it was, but I couldn't tell what he was saying. And my sponsor said, you mean to tell me, from your own experience with alcoholism, that this guy who was so drunk all the time somehow gathered up all this intent and called you on a specific day every year, even in the midst of that kind of burnout alcoholism, that he somehow found the wherewithal to call you every year on the same day to wish you a happy birthday? And I said, yeah. And he said, do you know how much effort that takes? And I said, yeah. And he said, then why did you hang up on him? And I said, because he was a drunk. And he said, you're a drunk. I don't like that. He said, you go to Wisconsin and make amends to him. And I said, no, you don't understand. He had a stroke and he's not capable of understanding anything anymore. The doctors have told us he's not even capable of continuous thought. Why would I go all the way across the country to make amends to somebody that won't even understand? And he said, you know, Bob, I don't care. This is about cleaning off our side of the street, okay? This isn't about cleaning off his side of the street. He's going to have to deal with that at some point in the future. But this is about cleaning off our side of the street, and whether he understands or not is not relevant to this conversation. So you just hitch it up and go to Wisconsin and make amends to him, and that's that. That's clear. So I did, okay? Went into the Grand Army home, King, Wisconsin. My dad's sitting there in a wheelchair. I hadn't seen him in, 10, 15 years. Little old gray-haired man. I mean, he used to toss me around like a... And here was this little guy, okay? Little old man, sitting in a wheelchair, half paralyzed. And I walked up to him and I said, hi, I'm your son, Bob. And he looked up and he got real excited, okay? And then I knew he understood. And I said, I need to talk with you. And if you don't mind, we'll just go off here in a corner someplace where we can be private. And I took him off in a place where we could do that. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. And he became very sad because he knew. And I said, but I don't drink anymore. And I'm in this program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and part of our recovery program is to make amends to people we've harmed, and I've harmed you. And this is what I did. And I regret having done that, and I'm willing to do whatever is necessary to balance the books. And when I told him I didn't have to drink anymore, he got real excited again. And I tried to be available to him. And it wasn't very long after that that it didn't make any difference. And see, what happened to him was he got adult onset diabetes. And they had to start cutting off his feet because you lose circulation, okay? And you get gangrene. So they cut off his feet, and then they called up and they said, they called up my Uncle Leif, and they said, we're going to have to take off his legs up to the thigh, and we may have to take one of his hands. And they talked about it, and they said, doctor said, you know, I don't know what the kinder thing is. You know, maybe we ought to just let him die. It's either that or just keep taking pieces off of him until he does die. And it was my uncle's decision, and I take no exception to that, that they let him die. See, my dad couldn't say anything, but he knew. I mean, somewhere down in there he knew, and he couldn't talk, and he couldn't move. So what he would do is he would sit in this hospital, and when people came anywhere near him, he would scream. The four horsemen of alcoholism are terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And despair is the worst. And he had no control over his life. And he knew he was going to die, and he couldn't stop it. And he died. And he's buried up behind that hospital. He died like a drunk dies. He died like people like you and I die when we drink. If that isn't a good reason to do the steps in this program, I don't know what is. I paid a lot of money back. I went through my amends list and I checked them off and I did them. Ten's about watching. It's about being vigilant. Okay? The instructions. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When you see it, ask God at once to remove it. Talk to someone about it. Make amends if you've harmed someone, and then resolutely turn your thoughts to someone you can help. Okay? I need to watch. You know, the tenth step is about be here now. Don't have your head off someplace in the clouds. This is about be where you are. See what's going on. See if the stuff that can kill people like you and I is going on in your head. And see if you need to turn away. This wonderful, wonderful exercise. Resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Why do I turn my thoughts? I'm taking the top of that periscope and I'm moving it out like that. Those manifestations of self which are involved in me looking here will kill me. And I need to look away. Okay? I think about how I can help someone else. And I get out of myself. 11's about discipline. I don't believe, and I hope I'm wrong, I don't believe that 5% of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous follow the directions. You believe that? It's true. The directions in the 11th step have to do with what we do when we get up in the morning. We ask God to keep our day free from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. We ask Him for intuitive thought or decision if we run into problems. We pray. We plan our day. Okay, write down a plan. Actually, it says we review our plans for the day. You know what I do? I write down my plans for the day the night before, and then I get up in the morning and review them. and I write down everything I think I'm going to do that day. Because the book says that there is some spiritual virtue in having a plan. If you don't believe any of this stuff, try it just to prove me wrong. You want a good exercise to try about the book? I've tried everything in there, and it all works. It says at some point in the past, we made a decision based on self. We see that at some point in the past, we made a decision based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. You believe that? You know what you do? Next time you get hurt, look back. See if you made a decision based on self that put you right there. It's infallible. Okay? Then you find out what the net result of making selfish decisions is. The book says, I make this plan for the day, and then I say, God, show me all through the day. This is in there. God, show me all through the day what my next step is to be, and please give me whatever I need to take care of the problems. Okay? I pray about all those people that I think I need to pray for, and then I go off and I do what I planned. Doesn't always work, but I try to. It says when I go to bed at night, I need to review my day. I need to see if I owe anyone an amend, if I've harmed someone. I need to take a look at whether I have put more into the day than I've taken out of it. Okay? That'll tell me whether I'm selfish or not. That'll tell me if I'm a giver or a taker. And if you really want to be happy sometime, and if you don't believe me, test it, go out and spend your whole day doing stuff for other people with no selfish motive involved at all. Just go out and say, I'm going to make somebody's life better today. And at the end of the day, see if you're happier than you normally are. You may get a really big surprise.
Let me share something with you. The perspective that I lose the most often is the perspective that everything is God's. Okay? All the stuff is God's. That means that the house and the car and the job and my wife and my children and my program and everything else is God's. That I am given the responsibility to care for those things. It's called stewardship. It does not alter the fact that the power that I have today is God's. It's not mine. And neither is any of the stuff. And neither is the responsibility or the acclaim or anything else you get from the power. And it occurred to me one day that we all sit in these meetings and that the last thing that we say in these meetings is, for thine is the kingdom, which is all the stuff. That's all the houses and the cars and the other people and all the stuff. And it says, for thine is the kingdom. And the power, because I don't have any, the only stuff I've got, the only power in my life is God's power. And the glory. I don't get anything special out of using the power well, because it's God's power and the glory belongs to Him. And we say that every time we go to an AA meeting, but I don't think a lot of people listen. Okay? Everything belongs to God, and especially all you wonderful people. Thanks a lot.